facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
It's December the 7th, 2022, the feast day of the great Ambrose, one of the doctors of the church. Welcome to the Cale Clark Show, 888-914-9149 is the number to call toll free to talk to me or my guest. I have a special guest today. I'll introduce you to him in just a moment. The email address for the program, Cale, C-A-L-E at relevantradio.com. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. Once again, the number to call, though, for the studio line is 888-914-9149. Well, as I said, it is the feast day of the great St. Ambrose, who, of course, was the teacher of St. Augustine. St. Augustine was also a doctor of the church. How about that? St. Augustine might be the greatest theologian of all time. I know there's a lot of stands for St. Thomas Aquinas, the angelic doctor, but hey, Pope Benedict is an Augustine guy. We can argue about that till the cows come home. But speaking of teachers, my guest today is one of my teachers, one of my professors. He aims to be right up there with St. Ambrose. In fact, Dr. Scott Hahn calls him the best Bible scholar in the English-speaking world. I concur with Dr. Scott Hahn. I think he's correct. He is the Distinguished Professor of Christian Origins at Houston Christian University. He's the author and editor of more than 90 books and hundreds of articles and reviews. He's lectured at major universities worldwide, has regularly appeared on Dateline NBC, on the BBC, the Discovery Channel, the History Channel, History Television, the National Geographic Channel, talking about Jesus, the Gospels, archaeology, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Bible. Of course, he's most proud of being a frequent guest on the Cale Clark Show. Dr. Craig Evans is my guest today. Dr. Evans, thank you for taking the time today. How are you?
Hey, I'm great, Cale, and thank you for that wonderful and somewhat apocryphal introduction. That was fun to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should mention that you are the John Bassanio Distinguished Professor of Christian Origins at Houston Christian University, because John Bassanio, of course, probably paid a lot of money for that, so we need to get his name on there, and obviously a great donor to the school.
Actually, John was a great preacher here in Houston, and money was donated in his name to show appreciation for him. That's where the chair came from, and I had the chance to meet him a couple of times before he passed away, well into his 80s, and he was just a marvelous, marvelous preacher of the gospel for decades. So that's where the chair comes from, and I'm just flattered to sit in it. I'm the first to sit in the Bassanio chair, so I think that's great.
Oh, that's great. I did not know that about him. So thanks for clearing that up. Well, I should tell everybody listening today that, you know, as I mentioned, I was Dr. Evans' student. So anything I say that you like, that is correct, that is accurate, is probably originating from him. And anything that's lame, any insight that's kind of sketchy, is definitely from me. And you've just returned, by the way, from a real tour de force that you had out in Denver at the annual meeting of what's called the SBL, which stands for the Society of Biblical Literature. It's a great Bible convention, the biggest in America. All the top scholars of the Bible are there. Anybody who's anybody is there. Scholars, teachers, Bible geeks. I have to ask you this. It's a little bit like a Star Trek convention for bibliophiles, if you will. Do Bible scholars have groupies? Do you have people like sort of rushing you to autograph your books and stuff when you're there? Or
you know, there is a little bit of that. It is kind of funny. They hope to sit next to you when a paper's being read or want to take you to lunch or something like that. It's kind of funny. Sometimes it's hard to get out of a room because you get intercepted by one person after another, and it makes you late to your next meeting because there's a queue lining up, and they want you to autograph a book or shake your hand or something like that. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, well, I have a friend who's an opera singer, and he says, believe it or not, opera singers have groupies too. They just roll up to your concerts in yachts instead of, you know. So, yeah, it's a weird.
Well, now I know what it's like to, you know, I know what it's like for Brad Pitt or Harrison Ford. So I sympathize. I totally get it.
Well, you're kind of like the Harrison Ford of biblical scholars. You know, we've done a lot of archaeology together, and there's a new Indiana Jones movie coming out. I saw the trailer. Maybe think of you. So Hopefully
yeah,
it's good.
It's going to be interesting to see an aged archaeologist in a wheelchair. I really look forward to it.
Yeah, we can kind of identify with that as we get older and older. Well, we'll get into the new book that you co-authored that caused such a sensation at the Society of Biblical Literature meeting in Denver last month in just a moment. But right now, Dr. Evans, I want to ask you about two titanic figures who just passed away within days of each other. E.P. and J.P., one Protestant, the other Catholic, E.P. Sanders, who died in November at the age of 85, and Father John Meyer, who everybody thinks is a Jesuit, but he's not. That's kind of a funny story as well, which we'll get into. He passed away. He taught for many years, among other places, at Notre Dame, and so he died in South Bend, Indiana at the age of 80 in October. And speaking of funny stories, Dr. Evans, E.P. Sanders, who was actually very influential in the shape of your career. Talk to me, before we get into his main contributions, what he is really known for, how he helped people think differently about the Bible, about Jesus, about St. Paul. Tell us about your connection with the late Dr. E.P. Sanders.
Well, I was finishing up the first draft of my doctoral dissertation, and that was in 1980. And of course, what's on my mind is, oh boy, I need to find a job. And the phone rang, and it was E.P. Sanders, and he wanted to know if I was available. I had sent in a CV and wanted to know if there might be something open in Canada at McMaster University. And somebody resigned, and they needed somebody for just 1 year. So he phoned up and wanted to know if I was interested. So I was really excited. I thought, wow, this is the E.P. Sanders. He laughed, said, yeah, I guess so. Well, while we were talking about what this job, this one-year job at McMaster would entail, suddenly there was a loud bang. I didn't know what was going on. Shouts. Ed dropped the phone on the floor. There was just bang, boom, bang, laughter. And finally, it all settled down. And he picked up the phone. He said, Craig, are you still there? And, you know, this is with a Texas drawl. This is where Ed Sanders was from. And I said, yeah. I'm still here. What happened? He said, I came under a squirt gun attack. As grad students had stormed into his office and was squirting him. And I thought, you know, and this is brand new to me. What did I know? You know, I'd never been a professor before. I had no idea that, I guess that's what happens. But it told me that the students loved him. He got along with everybody. He was somebody that everybody liked. And so he joked and said, well, when you come here to McMaster, now you know what to expect. And by the way, I went into my office when I was at Trinity Western University in British Columbia, and I was there for 21 years. And one day I tried to open my door, and I'm pushing against the door trying to get it to open, and it was squeaking. And finally I shoved it in enough so I could see into my office, and students had sneaked into my office and had filled it with balloons. So I can't say that I've ever come under a squirt gun attack, but my office was stuffed with inflated balloons. It was kind of funny. I couldn't even get into it.
Oh, that's a great story. Yeah, so the kind of fun that you can have with students. And I'm sure that some of your students at Houston Christian University and Houston Theological Seminary have probably got some squirt gun ideas now after listening to this. So, and you're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. My guest is Dr. Craig Evans, biblical scholar. We're talking about the passing of two major figures, what their contributions were. The late Dr. E.P. Sanders, Ed Sanders, who Dr. Evans just spoke about, and also Professor John Meyer. We'll get into that in just a minute. But let's get back to E.P. Sanders for a moment. As you just mentioned, he grew up in Texas. He's from, and by his own admission, he talked about how he grew up at the lower end of the economic spectrum, as it were, in Grand Prairie, Texas. But he went out for his graduate studies, and he actually went to Israel to learn Hebrew, and he started teaching at McMaster University in 1966. He eventually went on to Oxford University in the UK and then to Durham, North Carolina, to Duke University, where he was a professor of religion until he retired in 2005, and that's where he passed away as well just a few days ago. So Dr. Sanders cranked out a ton of books from the 1970s into the 1990s, and a couple of the big ones were called Paul and Palestinian Judaism. And there's another big one called Jesus in Judaism. So what was he trying to do there, Dr. Evans, in these works of his?
Well, he wanted to set the record straight in a very good way and make it clear that a lot of Christian scholarship and, unfortunately, a lot of Christian preaching did not understand the Jewish people very well, didn't understand Judaism very well. Mm-hmm. And so there was this caricature that had developed that goes all the way back probably to the 3rd and 4th centuries, and it's nurtured, unfortunately, in the Middle Ages, to the effect that Judaism is just all about legalism, that mm-hmm. there's no understanding of God's grace, there is no real place for faith. It's just all about works, trying to earn one's salvation by doing a lot of nitpicky, kind of almost meaningless kind of stuff concerned with purity and tradition and so on. And it's a terrible, terrible caricature. And even greater scholars, people who ought to know better and so on, often mm-hmm. would lapse into that kind of thing, that until Christ came, there was no concept of grace. And until Paul wrote, say, Romans or something, nobody really knew what faith was, or nobody really knew what it was to walk in the Spirit or something like that. And that was terribly unfair to Jewish scholarship, to the Jewish faith, to what the rabbis had taught, and so on. And Ed wanted to set the record straight and at the same time explain Paul a whole lot better. And that book came out in the late 1970s.
Yeah.
Ed Sanders himself, when it was published, had only just turned 40 years old. And so suddenly he was very well known. He hit the ball right out of the park, and he was in demand. Everybody wanted him to give lectures. And so I knew who he was. And so this mm-hmm. had happened when I was a PhD student. And, here 2 or 3 years later, he phones me up and wants to know if I could teach at McMaster where wow. he was. Teach for 1 year. Teach his classes, by the way, because he was granted a leave so that he could edit a collection of scholarly studies on this topic. And I was just blown away. I thought, this is the E.P. Sanders who phoned me up while I'm wow. typing away on my dissertation. It was quite an experience. But he completely retooled the whole industry. It's like that's the watershed moment. You know, is it pre-E.P. Sanders or post-E.P. Sanders? So he greatly impacted the whole idea of not just Paul, how to understand Paul, but how to understand Judaism better and understand the covenant better, what it really means to be forgiven by God, to have faith, to stand in the covenant, to be saved, to be forgiven. All of these categories became much sharper and better understood. And that's across the board. This isn't just a Protestant thing or a Catholic thing or something like that. It's across the board. So it's a major accomplishment, and he gets a lot of credit for it.
Yeah, and that's really well said. You're listening to the K.O. Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 888-914-9149. I'm talking with Dr. Craig Evans about the passing of two just titanic scholars of the Bible, E.P. Sanders, who we're talking about right now. Later on, we'll talk about Father John Meyer and his contribution to Jesus studies. And what's so great about the work of E.P. Sanders is he really rooted Jesus and also Paul in Judaism. And there was, let's face it, there was at that point, and we're seeing, unfortunately, in the world today, an ugly rearing of the head of anti-Semitism again. And there was a lot of anti-Semitism in biblical studies too, let's face it. So rooting those two figures, obviously our Lord Jesus and Paul, St. Paul, within the context of Judaism was so crucial. And let me ask you to explain something, because there's something called, and a lot of very famous Bible scholars talk about this. It's called the New Perspective on Paul. And of course, E.P. Sanders wrote about Paul too. And the stuff that he said, people tried to lump him in with others who wrote about this quote-unquote New Perspective on Paul. And he always said, no, that's not what it's about for me. What is the New Perspective on Paul, and why did he reject that label?
Well, yeah, a new perspective really does have its roots in Ed Sanders' book, Paul, Palestinian Judaism. That's really what got it going. But how people interpreted that, how they applied it, like one of the most loyal followers of Ed Sanders was the great Protestant evangelical Jimmy Dunn, who mm-hmm. taught for most of his career at Durham. But others said, no, it needs to be tweaked. And so whatever new perspective meant, it still was a tribute to this watershed moment that Ed Sanders brought on. But he didn't, he was resistant to being labeled and that way. And I think his own views shifted a little bit, too. Because keep in mind, when that book came out in 1977, and he finished writing it in 75, the Dead Sea Scrolls were still very much unpublished, these key texts. Mm. And one of the most important texts was the one that actually talks about works of the law. So the single most important Jewish text outside of the Bible itself that would shed light on what Paul was talking about when he spoke of works of law in his two letters, Galatians and Romans, that text hadn't been published yet. The fragments remained unpublished and did not get published until 1990 or 91, and that's several years after Paul of Palestinian Judaism had come out. And so that just impacted it still further. And so the new perspective is somewhat better informed and is much more current than where Ed Sanders left it in the late 70s. But Ed's the one that, you know, just blew open the door. Everybody had to say, you know what, I don't think we do understand Judaism properly. I think we are unfair in saying it's nothing more than a religion of works righteousness, that there's no concept of God's grace, there's no concept of faith. These are caricatures. They're just plain wrong, and we need to drop it. And I think Ed gets a huge amount of credit for opening the eyes of scholars to those concerns.
Well, thanks for clearing that up, Dr. Evans. We got to take a break in a second, but just before we do that, because you mentioned the great scholar James Dunn, who, of course, was also a friend of yours, I have to ask you, just as a moment of levity, I have to ask you about the story about James Dunn and St. Peter's Fish involving you guys at a restaurant.
Oh, I was with Jimmy Dunn. This is how I really got to know him well. This was 1992. James Charlesworth of Princeton had organized this Jesus Hillel conference in Israel. And there we were together. Jimmy and I roomed together. And so we're at Capernaum at a favorite tourist spot where people like to eat St. Peter's fish. It actually is genetically related to the very fish that we think that was in the waters in those days at the Sea of Galilee. So there we are, and it comes out on the spit, and it's all been roasted, and the head is still on. Jimmy had made a point of that. Don't cut the head off. Leave the head on the fish. I want to look him right in the eye. Well, the fish arrived. His mouth was open, and everybody was laughing, and Jimmy turned away, and I took a shekel, and I stuck it in the fish's mouth, and I said to Jimmy, you know, if you check this fish out carefully, maybe you'll find a shekel and you can pay the temple tax. He laughed, ha, ha, ha. He looked down at his plate, and he saw that shekel stuck in the fish's mouth, and he let out a big laugh, and everybody was taking pictures of it. So, and by the way, that's become a custom now. Whenever I take students or people to Israel, we all have to have a fish and stick a shekel in its mouth.
I love that. I love that. Obviously, referencing that great miracle that Jesus did. Hey, Peter, just go fish, and you'll find enough for the temple tax for you and for me. That's incredible. What a great story. I'll tell you, we're not going to lure you with any false pretenses here. We're going to be right back on the Cale Clark Show. Talk about Jesus and history with Dr. Craig Evans. 888-914-9149. We'll be right back. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values. And fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
Faith, facts, and fun. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
And we are having a lot of fun with today's guest, Dr. Craig Evans, biblical scholar. You can call in if you have a question for him, 888-914-9149. I was telling producer Jim during the break about our great times in Israel working on archaeological digs. And he said, you sound like you're just like grown up little kids digging in the dirt and just having fun. And you know, we did, you know, one thing, little kids can't do is, you know, we were able to have a beer at the end of the night. You know, we had one of the Maccabee beers that are over there. Judas the Hammer, he wants you to get hammered. No, we can't do that. Drunkenness is a sin. But we did have some good times, didn't we, Dr. Evans? And certainly archaeology is something that you've been involved with a lot. You founded the Dead Sea Scrolls Institute at Trinity Western University in British Columbia, and you've got a lot of experience with that. The 75th anniversary of the founding, or the finding of the first Dead Sea Scroll this year, right?
That's right. Yeah. In fact, my doctoral father, William Brownlee, and his good friend, John Trevor, were in Israel in 1947, 75 years ago.
Wow.
And they just, I mean, talk about a providential thing. There they are with their expertise, and they're there for other reasons. And their whole careers were then turned around when they looked upon these scrolls that were taken to where they were in East Jerusalem. And that transformed everything. And so that was 1947, 75 years ago.
Yeah.
And I had the privilege many years after that, 30 years later, in 1977, to study with these two gentlemen. And of course, that really set me on my career as well.
Yeah, and hopefully you had the good sense not to smoke cigarettes around the Dead Sea Scroll fragments as the original researchers did. It's incredible to see these photos. They're like these precious, precious artifacts. And, you know, they're guys with these cigarettes with these long, you know, ashes hanging off. Just like, you're just afraid they're going to hit the parchment. But it's incredible. The different standards today, obviously, in terms of how we handle these things. But there you go. We got a lot of holy smoke here, that's for sure. Well, listen, let's talk about also, we were talking about the late E.P. Sanders and his research on Jesus. And speaking of Jesus, both E.P. Sanders and the late Father Meyer talked a lot about something called the historical Jesus, or someone called the historical Jesus. And your new book, I should say books, because it's a two-volume set co-authored by late Dr. Colin Brown, which just came out. This caused such a great sensation at the SBL Society of Biblical Literature meetings in Denver just a few weeks ago. It's called A History of the Quests for the Historical Jesus. I have to ask you to explain to our listeners, Dr. Evans, who or what is the historical Jesus? People say that and say, well, hang on here. There's only one Jesus. How can there be a historical Jesus? How is that different from the Jesus that I know? What is that all about?
A lot of it's philosophy. What happened in the 1700s was growing skepticism. And the idea was, can we really trust the Gospels? Because after all, Jesus walks on water, he stills the storm, he casts out evil spirits. We don't even think they existed. He heals people. Come on, did those things really happen? And so can the Gospels be trusted? Maybe the Gospels are the things of mythology.
Hmm.
And so the idea was, why don't we study these as we would any other secular literature, not as inspired texts or authoritative, but just as ancient documents. And so if we found a bunch of ancient documents talking about people walking on water or raising the dead, we'd be skeptical, wouldn't we? And so that's how it got started. So there was a philosophy, you might say, a world perspective that was hostile toward the idea of God existing or God doing anything. And a lot of theism was deism back in the 18th century. And so, yeah, God's there somewhere. He created the universe, wound it up like a clock, and then took a holiday. But he doesn't really intervene. And miracles were seen as interventions. In fact, they would even be talked about, miracles were violations of the laws of nature or something like that. And so that was the spirit of the age, what the Germans call the Zeitgeist, the spirit of the age.
Mm-hmm.
And so the quest got underway with that in mind. And so that's what was going on. And people were calling it a quest in the 20th century. They weren't calling it that in the 19th century. But anyway, hundreds of books were written in French and German, English mostly, and talking about what we can or can't know about the historical Jesus. And so there was a rationalization. You know, Jesus didn't walk on the water. He was walking on the beach. It was just an optical illusion. The wind was blowing some, you know, the water onto the beach, and Jesus was in 2 inches of water.
Wow.
He didn't really heal anyone in any kind of medical sense. it was mind over matter. He made people feel good, psychosomatic problems, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. People who were mentally distressed, they really weren't demon-possessed, and Jesus just calmed them down, you know. My favorite, and this is this is my favorite explanation. How did Jesus feed the 5,000? Well, basically, he gave 5,000 people a guilt trip. He could tell Jesus had a good olfactory sense. He could smell the salami. He knew it was there. And people just didn't want to whip out their packed lunches that they kept mm-hmm. hidden under their coats because they might have to share. So the little boy is willing to share. He says, "Here, you know, here, Jesus, you can have my lunch." And Jesus holds it up. This is why there's enough here to feed everybody. They all hung their heads in shame. Everybody started reaching, pulling out their big sacks loaded with subs,
kosher dill,
and fruit and fish. And I mean, in fact, there was so much food, there were just 12 baskets of leftovers. You know, it's no wonder the crowd was tired and starting to stagger. They're lugging around a week's worth of groceries. So there was this rationalizing mm-hmm. kind of interpretation. In other words, let's come up with a Jesus who's a nice guy. We all admire him. He teaches good morals. He teaches us to love one another and be at peace and forgiving and take care of the poor. So it really got the social gospel going. Soup kitchens, you know, things like that. We're Alcoholics Anonymous. This is what the gospel is. But Jesus really didn't walk on water, really didn't heal anybody. So that was what it was all about. And then what Colin Brown did was he says, "I think you've missed it." And so you need to back up much further. And he was, you know, he was a brilliant man, and he could see through a lot of this, the smoke and mirrors, and start talking in a way, in a very sophisticated way about the philosophy, the hermeneutics, the epistemology behind all of this. So he's really changed the conversation. He's gotten scholarship out of a 200-year-old rut and has put us on a different path. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, as the years go by. And it's two big, huge books, two volumes, 700 pages each. So it's going to have, I think, a big impact.
Oh, absolutely. And it's already, these two books, A History of the Quests for the Historical Jesus, because there are a few of them, the third quest, I don't know if we're still in it or if it's considered now closed, but that's the most recent one. They're getting great rave reviews, these two volumes. They're already on several best of 2022 lists. And so congratulations to you on this. And and we have heard, a lot of us have heard growing up, a lot of homilies about the quote-unquote miracle of sharing and the de-supernaturalization of the Gospels, kind of trying to make them appeal more palatable to people. But that's just absolutely disrespectful to first century readers as well. These guys weren't stupid. They weren't gullible. Heck, they still can't figure out how the Romans did a lot of their engineering projects in the first century, or how the Egyptians built the pyramids without hydraulics. These guys weren't gullible. They knew an honest to goodness miracle when it happened, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I agree. And the other thing too is sometimes the Gospels are compared to literature, where the literature itself is not produced by eyewitnesses. These are stories that are handed down. They're kind of like the Greco-Roman myths. But the Gospels, you know, Jesus is a public person. So this is not some legend about some guy that lived hundreds of years ago, we don't know when. In other words, he's not Buddha. This is Jesus. And Paul himself, and no one disputes seven of his letters. Mm-hmm. You know, he wrote, there are 13 that have his name on them. But seven of them are accepted without question by everybody. And in two of those letters, he talks about the disciples, Jesus' actual disciples. He even talks about his family. And so how in the world can somebody be invented and stories told about somebody that he never did, when everybody who knew him, his actual disciples and family members, they all know he's from Nazareth. They all know mm-hmm. the people. I mean, in the gospel stories themselves, they say, well, we know everybody here. You know, we know his mother, she's here. We know other people, part of his family, right here in Nazareth. So this is not some, you know, foggy, distant, from the past mm-hmm. legend about somebody. It's all eyewitness. And of course, one of the things that Jesus teaches his disciples is to be truthful. Mm-hmm. And so we're to believe that they're all just a bunch of liars making up stories about things Jesus never did. I mean, it's to me incredible. And yeah. The other thing, and this, you know, Cale, you can second this from your own experience, and that's archaeology. Archaeologists mm-hmm. trust the Gospels, and it doesn't matter if they're Christian or not. They can be Jewish, they can be agnostic, whatever. Mm-hmm. When you dig tons of dirt, when you ask guys like you and me and 50 other people to come for 2 weeks or 4 weeks, spend money on your own dime, be a volunteer digger, dig up tons of debris, dirt, rocks, and so on, and you don't want to dig in the wrong place. You want to know where to dig, and you want to know how to interpret it, right? Yeah, and you know that. And so they consult the best sources. And that's always Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, the four Gospels in the New Testament, the book of Acts, and, of course, the first century Jewish historian Josephus. They always do. And if the Gospels were fictions, telling us stories about somebody that really didn't do any of these things, they're just making up stories, I don't think the Gospels would exhibit that kind of verisimilitude, that kind of accuracy and truthfulness that archaeologists of any religious stripe always use, because they find them accurate and helpful. And I think that really does answer the skeptic. And so the answer is sweat. People work hard and sweat, and you don't get out in the sun and dig and move tons of earth because you're following an untrustworthy source. People just don't do that.
Yeah, that's so well said. Yeah, we've got the tired muscles to prove it. Absolutely. You're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. My guest is Dr. Craig Evans, 888-914-9149. And you mentioned that scholars, Dr. Evans, no matter what their personal beliefs are, they might be atheists in their personal life, they might be agnostics, they might belong to some other faith, but they do rely on the New Testament documents for historical accuracy about many things, trying to find archaeological sites relating to the books of the New Testament, for example. And also it's true when it comes to Jesus and history as well. One of the things that the late E.P. Sanders did in one of his books, and this was, by the way, in kind of a more popular level book that he wrote about Jesus, he listed 15 facts that scholars of all stripes will recognize. Okay, this is what we believe about Jesus of Nazareth, his life, his activities, what his aims might have been, all of that sort of stuff. And so, I mean, I could give you the list of the 15 things if you want, but you know them as well as I do, 15 things that virtually every scholar would believe about Jesus as a historical figure. Then we come to Professor John Meyer, and he's well known. He passed away, obviously, in October at the age of 80, taught at Notre Dame for many years, the Catholic University of America, and other places. And his fame derived primarily from writing a series of books about Jesus that were called A Marginal Jew. That was the name of the series, A Marginal Jew. Why did he call them that? What's the origin of that title?
You know, I don't know, but I suspect, I think I know. And I think there's a double entendre. Jesus is marginalized in his own world. In other words, he's not Caesar. He's not elite. He's not like, you know, the Tetrarch of Galilee, like one of the sons of Herod the Great, Herod Antipas. So he's not wealthy. He's not privileged. So in that sense, he's marginalized. His disciples are marginal people. They're not wealthy people. They're not movers and shakers. They don't have a lot of power. But I think also, if I understand John, and I knew him personally, in fact, I communicated with him only a few months ago, and he wrote a glowing endorsement for Colin Brown's book on the history of the quests of the historical Jesus, which we've been talking about. Yeah. So there's that connection right there. But I think he sees Jesus marginalized in scholarship. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the little bit of a dig. Maybe I'm wrong on that. Maybe he's explained it to somebody else. But I think that's what he's saying. There's a little bit of a wink there. And John had a sense of humor. And, he was incisive and a good thinker. Everything he wrote, you wanted to read and take seriously because he was that good. So yeah. I suspect the marginal Jew, on the one hand, it's obvious, yes, he didn't walk. Jesus didn't walk in the courts of Caesar. He was on the outside perimeter of the power. And you know what? I think there's a lot of modern scholars that don't take him seriously enough either, so that Jesus ends up getting marginalized in New Testament scholarship. So that's my take.
Yeah, that I think that echoes with what he says in the book. And it's interesting because the first volume of his series on the historical Jesus, A Marginal Jew, Volume 1, it opens up with a really intriguing thought experiment. Can you tell us a little bit about this from Father John Meyer?
Yeah, he talks about, you know, like he the mindset he wants to carry throughout this project. And by the way, our listeners might not know, he wrote 5 volumes. And I pulled them off the shelf before the show began tonight just to check and flip through the pages. The longest one's 1,100 pages. The shortest one's like 500. It averages out about 700 pages per volume, 3,500 pages. And by the way, the print is not large. It's smallish. So you're talking about a monstrous work that he has produced. And so, you know, this is just huge what he's managed to do. And so he starts off with this thought experiment. What if we had some people who sat down together? One of them's a Catholic, one of them's a Protestant, one of them might even be agnostic or atheist, one of them's one of them's Jewish, it's kind of like a council has been convened, and they're going to assess the evidence, and of course the primary evidence would be Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but all evidence that talks about Jesus, the archaeology, the literature, everything you can think of, and assess it in a way that doesn't sell out to denominational preferences. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, you know, that was big of John, because John could always say, well, listen, I'm a Catholic, I'm a priest, I know what my confessions, creeds, and catechisms all say, and so my Jesus will conform to those. But instead, he says, no, what I'm going to do as a historian, I'm going to look at the evidence with these other guys at the table, and if I can't convince this Jewish scholar that I have this right, or I can't convince this Protestant that I have it right, then maybe I need to rethink it. And so he wrote that way, and I think that's why his 5 volumes, they don't fly in the face of Catholicism. There's nothing there that's going to get anybody upset, but they're respected. When you read his literature, you think, I'm reading a learned, insightful piece of scholarship by somebody who really knows what he's talking about. And it's not obvious that he's Catholic. You don't read, you know, you just open up any one of those 5 volumes and just start reading. You don't think, oh, this guy obviously is a priest.
Interesting.
No, you don't.
Yeah, that part's purely written from a historical perspective. That's really intriguing. We've got to take a quick break right now on the Cale Clark Show. 888-914-9149. We're talking with Dr. Craig Evans about Jesus and history. We'll be right back. The Catholic Order of Foresters, the sponsor of our studio's line, is hiring today. Several positions are available throughout the United States. Visit relevantradio.com/forester to learn more about how you can find your vocation with Catholic Order of Foresters, an Illinois Life Insurance Society, not licensed in all states.
This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back to the program, 888-914-9149. We're talking with Dr. Craig Evans about Jesus, St. Paul, history. A couple of titanic scholars in the field of biblical studies just passed away. E.P. Sanders, who wrote the monumental Jesus and Judaism, and also Professor John Meyer and his prolific A Marginal Jew series about Jesus and history. And just before the break, we were talking about how Professor Meyer kind of had this thought experiment of an unpapal conclave, as he called it, a Catholic, a Protestant, a Jewish person, a Muslim, and an agnostic are locked in the basement of Harvard Divinity School's library until they can come up with a conclusion on what they can agree on about Jesus from what we can learn from history. Now, obviously, this would be kind of a I guess you could say, a very mere Christianity portrait of Jesus. We got to go beyond that. You've got to eventually, C.S. Lewis says, okay, well, you know, once you have something about Jesus, you got to figure out what you're going to do with that. You've got to, you know, pick an ecclesial body here and the arguments for that. But that's kind of another story. We're talking about history here. And Professor Meyer, Father John Meyer, he was also an incredibly kind and humble soul. I actually had as I'm sure you did too, Dr. Evans, had the chance to talk to him. I saw his kindness in action once at a conference. There's this guy who was kind of, I would say, a little eccentric. He had kind of self-published his own book on the Gospels, and it was kind of weird. He was giving it out to everybody like candy. And I don't know, this guy just seemed like he maybe had some issues. And he came up to Professor Meyer, and he gave him a copy of his book. And Professor Meyer could have completely, you know, big-timed him and said, you know, what is this? But he was so kind. He acted like the guy gave him the greatest Christmas present he ever received. And it was super sincere, too. Incredibly sincere. And I know he was incredibly helpful to students and anybody. I even emailed him once a few years ago when he was at Notre Dame, and he was very kind to reply. I mean, who am I? And he answered a question that really helped me with a paper I was working on. And to talk about the endorsement that he gave your new book just before he passed away, it's a great story, too.
Well, it is, and I thanks for mentioning it, and I opened up the emails right in front of me. It dates April 19th. I had emailed Father Meyer to ask him. We had shortlisted his name as an endorser for Colin Brown's two-volume history of the quest of the historical Jesus. Would he endorse it? And of course, Father Brown's a big, or Father Meyer is a huge name in historical Jesus studies because of this five-volume work he's done, A Marginal mm-hmm. Jew. So he wrote back and said he was intrigued and he would be happy to look at the manuscript, which he did, and then he wrote a really nice endorsement, which, as it turned out, was among the last things that he wrote before he went to heaven. And so when I addressed him in the email, I put the initials SJ, Society of Jesus, behind his name. And I just, for some reason in my mind, I thought he was a Jesuit. So he writes back, and I'm looking at the email. He says, "Thank you for your gracious email and your kind invitation, though I should perhaps begin with a smile and a small correction. In your email, you made the same mistake made by," now listen to this, Cale, "made by Pope Emeritus Benedict." Now, you know, that I just thought, wow, I made the same mistake the Pope made. I mean, that made my day. So I thought, what mistake is this? When he praised my work in his own book, Jesus of Nazareth, and you know I was one of the reviewers of the Pope's trilogy, just mm-hmm. outstanding Amazing. Work. And anyway, John goes on to say in his email, he called me a Jesuit. And of course, I could just see the wink in his eye. He says, "Of course, I've been called worse things in my lifetime." And then he goes on to say, no, he's a priest from the Archdiocese of New York.
That's
he's
right.
not a Jesuit. So he goes on to tease and says, "I think it's a Jesuit conspiracy. They're really good at PR. They're just trying to claim Father Meyer for themselves."
Oh, anyway, that is
that's
so
the
funny.
Kind of sense of humor he had.
Oh, yeah.
And what a guy. And, you know, you were talking about how kind he is. I would see him almost every year at Society of Biblical Literature meetings, and I would introduce my MA students who were hoping to do mm-hmm. PhD work, perhaps at Notre Dame, and I introduced several of them to him during receptions or whatever, wine and cheese and so mm-hmm. on. And Father Meyer would always take time to talk to him about what was involved in a PhD program, the kind of students he worked with at Notre Dame, things to expect. I always thought that was so gracious of him.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I always thought well of him. And, you know, we were at that big conference that Pope Benedict initially sponsored. He did mm-hmm. Retire a few months before the conference took place, and Pope Francis went ahead and convened it anyway.
Yep.
So my wife and I got to meet him. He's an interesting guy. And John Meyer was there. And so yeah. we got to hang out together and have dinner together and run around in Rome and get some gelato.
Yeah, that's the best.
You know, and it that was a wonderful week. Jenny and were in the St. Martha Hotel with the Holy Father himself. As they said, look, you're going to be on the second floor, and Pope Francis is down at that end of the hall, and you're at the other end. Don't go down the hall and bang on his door. Leave him alone.
Exactly.
He'll use elevator A. Use elevator B. We said, you know, that's okay. We can live with that. But it was a great experience. And I've seen the late Father Meyer in action many times, and just a wonderful guy and a brilliant scholar.
Oh, yeah. May he rest in peace, along with E.P. Sanders as well. And hey, no practical jokes in the St. Martha Hotel. You can't order pizza at the Pope's room at 3 a.m. It's verboten. It's not allowed. All right, let's go to the phones right now. David is on the line from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. What's your question for Dr. Craig Evans, David?
Yeah, a few years ago, I'd read a couple books, both by Jews, about Jews in the time of Jesus. One was by a rabbi to his good Catholic friend, and the other one was a bit more angry. But both of them seem to say kind of the same thing. They seem to have very little problem with the teaching of Jesus, that his teaching seems to be kind of in the vein of what was the kind of discussion back then. And on the other hand, they seem to have a lot more troubles with Paul's teachings. Kind of similarly, I read a book that compared Paul's teachings to the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the conclusion of that writer was that the people that wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls, he felt, were much more in sync with the Jews of that time, as far as like faith and works, whereas he thought Paul was saying some new things.
David, that's a great question. I'm just going to jump in, just because we only got about 2 minutes left here, so I know Dr. Evans is chomping at the bit to answer this one, so go ahead, Dr. Evans.
Well, you know, it's a good observation, and David, you're right on the money, because Jesus, a lot of polemics developed in the Middle Ages, and that's the problem. It really poisoned the conversation, and we're past that. The discovery of the scrolls really helped. The refounding of Israel really helped. A whole new level of respect between Jewish and Christian scholars who sit down together. And we don't have time, but I could talk about all kinds of Jewish scholars, living and no longer living, that I have known in my career. And we study the Qumran scrolls together. We now study the rabbinic texts together with new eyes. And you're right, there's this recognition that, hey, in fact, one book came out called The Jewish Reclamation of Jesus. That was the point of that book, was that Jewish scholars have rediscovered Jesus. They still, though, Jewish scholars struggle with Paul, because Paul goes on to say, hey, if you're in Christ, what you eat doesn't really matter. Well, with rabbinic Judaism, you know, it does matter. And so there are still some sticking points. But I think even Paul is being rediscovered as a Jewish thinker in his time, and somebody who had something to say, who ought to be listened to and respected. Your question's complicated. It would take a whole lot of conversation to work through it. But I think we're in a new era where there is respect. Doesn't mean that there's compromise necessarily, but there's respect. We sit down at the table, we look at the text, and we listen to each other, and nobody's interested in misrepresenting anyone or caricaturing anyone, or showing disrespect. We listen to one another, and we learn from one another, and it's a good thing.
Absolutely. And on that note, we got to get out of here. Dr. Craig Evans, if you need him, hey, you can find him on Twitter, at Dr. Craig Evans. Also, his website is craigaevans.com, and you can check out the new book, wherever fine books are sold. You can find it on Amazon or anywhere. It's published by Zondervan, A History of the Quests for the Historical Jesus, magnificent two-volume work. Dr. Evans, thank you so much for taking the time. Really appreciate you. And we'll see you next time on The Cale Clark Show. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.